The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest-growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks, the first and number one global fintech radio show on the planet. I'm Brett King, your host, and we're here this week in London at the Innovate Finance Global Summit. Our great friend Dave Birch is here with me too. You're going to be hearing from him very, very shortly. But before we get to that, a few conference announcements. Finovate Spring is coming up on April 26th and 27th at the San Jose Convention Center. If you want a discount for that event, don't forget to use the code BREAKINGBANKS20 and you'll get a nice 20% discount. You can thank me later. EFMA is having their distribution conference on April 26th to 28th as well. And I think Jim Morales is going to be there for that event. BAI is hosting their Innovation Global Awards again. Applications are due for those by April 28th, so don't forget to get them in right away. And if you want some more Finovate goodness, their Finovate Developer Conference, Findevor, is prepping for London on June 12th and 13th. So get your tickets for that now. You can also use the discount code BBanksDevR20, and you'll get 20% off there too. And we're very pleased to announce, delighted to announce, that we are going to be the official podcast partner for Money 2020 in Europe at Copenhagen this year. Both FinTech 5 and podcast and Breaking Banks, myself and Sam Moore, will be there at Money 2020 to partner as the official podcast partner for Money 2020 Europe. You can find out about all these events on our conferences page. Don't forget to go to www.breakingbanks.com, and they're going to be listed there along with the discount codes.
Okay, so we're here at Innovate Finance at the Global Summit. I'm here with Dave Birch.
Hi, Brett.
You only just made it in time.
Track failure at Waterloo.
Track failure at Waterloo. Did you take the tube here then?
I assume it was agents of a foreign power testing the resilience of our infrastructure. Yeah. I could have told them beforehand.
Did you hear about the they had all of the tornado sirens in Texas go off at once?
Oh, I heard that. Yeah. Someone hacked into them. Yeah.
That's pretty interesting. If they can hack the there's probably low tech stuff.
Oh, some people think it was the Russians. I think it's Skynet flexing.
Skynet.
Its
muscles. Yeah. Just testing us out.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes. Or DeepMind.
Yes.
All right.
When it's not playing Go.
So we are here. Can you describe for us Guild Hall, Dave? Have you been here before? This is my first time to Guild Hall.
Yeah, no, of course. This is the very heart of the old city of London. In fact, the city of London is actually sort of a distinct entity. This is where the Lord Mayor of London actually used to hang out. In fact, I think probably still does hang out. So it's the heart of the city, you know?
And why is it called Guild Hall?
I have absolutely no idea. Presumably it's where the guilds originally used to gather. Yes. To conspire against the general public.
Yes.
Whereas now they do it down at the FCA.
or at Westminster.
It's all changed.
Yes. Okay, well, so London is, it's a beautiful day in London.
It's a beautiful day.
Yeah, it's the weather's better here than it was in New York.
Very nice weather. And we're all looking forward to the television later on because Panorama are going to do that thing about the Bank of England fixing LIBOR.
There you go.
So it's a very London-centric day.
Very London-centric day. Okay. So to our first guest, we have Ruth Wanderhofer from, I hope I pronounced that correctly. She's with Treasury and Trade Solutions at Citi, but she is the Global Head of Regulatory and Market Strategy, or as Dave said, the Queen of...
She is the Queen of RegTech. Don't let her be too modest.
That's fine. So, Ruth, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Brett, for having me.
Now, you're based in Canary Wharf, but I guess you travel a fair bit?
Yes. In fact, being a global head, it's quite challenging, and you often need to speak to people directly as opposed to doing remote things. So, I do travel quite a lot, yeah.
So where are you focusing your efforts on at the moment?
Well, at the moment, Europe is still a very interesting space in terms of the whole RegTech developments. But of course, Asia has seen some developments and there's a lot of government focus on promoting RegTech. If you look at, for example, Hong Kong or Singapore, looking also, of course, at the OCC FinTech Charter in the US very closely. So I would say US being our home market is a key pillar, but Asia next to Europe is also the other areas that are key.
So I ran into Sopendru from MAS today here as well. Is there any other regulators here today?
Oh, yes, there are lots of them. Even Middle Eastern regulators from UAE, supervisors I spoke to last week, and we all found out that we actually catch up here in person. So there are lots of regulators that are very interesting to see and actually to engage with the community and amongst themselves. So it's almost not only a hotspot for fintechs and banks and industry participants, but also for supervisors and regulators.
Now, I know Dave has some questions for you as well, but I'll kick off with an easy one. How is artificial intelligence going to change the way we think about regulation?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I mean, Sir Tim this morning laid out the challenges that have been encountered through the internet because, of course, people, humans, are not always doing good. And the question is...
So that was Sir Tim Berners-Lee, right?
Yes, exactly. And, of course, then the question as to how AI would alter all of that. And if you ask about AI in regulation, I think we're still not very near to that space, but it certainly should be interesting because AI may be able to capture all these interconnections that are increasingly complex, even if we just look at a domestic regulatory environment. And I still have that dream that given some of those immensely digital and borderless technologies such as distributed ledger, blockchain, and AI itself, we actually should be looking at much more global consistency of regulation because these things will operate borderless anyway. And if regulators don't get together early on, they will miss the boat. And maybe AI would then eventually take over without them even noticing. So that's a very interesting question.
Can I just ask, you've not been on a chat show before, Ruth, because you didn't mention your book at all in that. Could you just...
Yeah, well, I wrote two books about regulation and the complexity and the impacts on the business and also on competition and economics, really, specifically in light of transaction banking, which is still a pillar of moving funds and funding the economy globally. And of course, Citi in that space is one of the bigger players. And I think as we see, I mean, the second book on transaction banking and the implications of Basel and other legislations really lays out the interconnections and some of the inconsistencies between regulations, not only between countries, but even looking at the same substance and how it's been implemented. And of course, when regulators always wanted to, after the crisis, look at minimizing risk. But what they've actually done with a lot of the regulation is shift risk into a new space, which is even less easy to control than in the past. So I think AI may play a role in the future. But I mean, coming back to the earlier comments, I think it's a question of Skynet and all other sort of developments where if it's out of our control, that's going to be very difficult because I think already today supervisors don't necessarily understand the implications of the laws and how these interconnections actually maybe target the wrong goal.
I think it's a really interesting point about how AI would actually be deployed in practice because nobody's going to switch it. We're not going to abolish the FCA and run it on a PC instead, right? Well, not soon, I mean, downstream. But we might want to use AI in order to help with the construction of the regulation because right now, you know, the regulators sit around, AML is a very good example of this. So the regulators sit around and say, okay, well now, as well as a copy of a gas bill, people have to have a copy of their electricity bill as well when they open a bank account. And they have no cost benefit analysis around this. They have no idea whether this will actually have any effect or not. So it could be that the first role of AI is actually helping regulators to form and test the regulation. You see what I mean?
Rather than replacing the regulators. Yeah, almost to sandbox regulatory ideas themselves, which is a good idea. And on the flip side, having mentioned RegTech earlier on, even managing their own supervisory load with what they have in the system today and to help them to make sense of all the submissions they're getting from banks and other non-banks that they supervise is also a role where AI could come in to actually triage and look at consistency patterns and how well they can actually then supervise and take action based on that because the thousands of pages that had been submitted even years ago to such regulators such as the FSA at the time, I'm not entirely sure in how far they were efficient in wading through them and taking the right decision based on all this content. So computers will need to help there.
Yeah, it's unreasonable to expect them to. Yeah. Can I ask you a couple of questions about sort of specific regulatory initiatives? Because I'm very curious about the you said things have to harmonize in the long run. Of course, that's true. But right now they're not. And I'm very curious in particular about the difference between Europe and the US because the proposed OCC fintech. So in Europe, the thrust of the legislation right now is to kind of separate the payments regulation from the sort of general banking regulation and to separate systemic risk away from places where people want to experiment and play. The OCC FinTech Charter is kind of the other way. Instead of having like a new bank that only does payments, like the Indian Payment Institution or something like that, it's like having a new general class of nationally chartered bank, which obviously the incumbent national chartered banks are going to resist. Mm. And so I'm just, is there any sign of any kind of accommodation between Europe and the US, or do you see them being very separate for the time being?
I think you're right that they've gone a very separate route, but I think we're also at a very early stage of these developments, given all the very objective feedback we've given across various industry bodies to the OCC in terms of how to sensibly approach this and how to maybe look at countries like Switzerland that have done a fintech license really in the peer-to-peer space. I think that is an area that people understand well and can cement well, but there's so many other business models where regulators first need to understand how these operate and what risks these could trigger before they even sit down and say we do a fintech charter or licensing regime. So I think the thinking may have been a little bit divergent, but I would hope that we still converge at the end of the day to make sure we don't increase more systemic risk. There's also a general problem with all these new players that then partner with banks or want to do certain things on their own. If the liability regime, which is currently in Europe and the US, designed in a way that the bank takes the end liability for anything that may go wrong,
which is the PSD2,
for example, that over time, as more technology providers do sensible and real pieces of the value chain and deliver parts and deal with data or deal with funds in a certain way, that these parties will have to become increasingly more accountable, and you can't say backstop is always the bank. So there has to be also a parallel shift on the liability side. So OCC is early days. I think Europe hasn't thought about fintech licenses at the EU level. The payment space has been already separated since 2007 to 2009, and now we see the second wave. But again, payments is also only one element of fintech. So I think it's quite difficult. I mean, that these are the things we know how to bucket them. There's so many other things out there which we haven't even yet siloed in a way so that we can understand how regimes should apply.
I've got a question. Dave, can I ask a question?
Just don't mention augmentation.
Augmentation.
Too early in the day.
So, Ruth, one question I've got is around the fact that we see the emergence of these really interesting experience-driven businesses. Ant Financial, with the way they've structured their businesses, tends to be sort of around some aggregated utility in banking. So you see payments functions, you see value stores like M-Pesa and Alipay and WeChat, and you see now access to credit, which is becoming more and more contextual. So we seem to be moving, a lot of the new capabilities that are emerging tend to be about utility that surfaced through this experience layer, not about a product through a channel. Now, regulation's very defined in terms of a product and a policy and a channel and how that's managed. So how do we bridge that gap when we start having all these experiences, initially through smartphones, but now through voice user interface, and then in the future with augmented reality smart glasses? Yeah, it's got to augmented. How do we bridge that gap when regulation just is so far away from that future?
So some fundamental comments. I think the real problem is, of course, that having worked through 15, 20 years of regulation that always claimed to be technology neutral and future proof, we're kind of figuring out that with the technology speed of advance that we see right now, actually what we did in the past was never really future proof, and it was never really technology neutral. And the other layer of complexity is that traditionally until now, regulators prefer entity-based regulation, because at the end of the day, they want to blame someone if things go wrong. And I think this is a fundamental point if you look, for example, at all these distributed models such as Bitcoin, blockchains, and other things, because there's actually no one you can directly blame. So there, then the question is, how do you create a governance and something you can control better? And then someone within the governance will have to have the sort of scheme control and be the entity to be blamed if things go wrong. So I think there's a whole path of thinking about maybe a shift from entity-based legislation to service-based. I think that is what really should happen. But again, it's the supervisors and the regulators that need to be far more engaged in all these developments to understand how these services would work and how the experience layers actually function, to see where they should actually do something, because I think it's very dangerous to continue the path of very detailed, prescriptive, rule-based, entity-based legislation making, because that really hasn't worked well in the past. We have to come to principles, especially when we need to protect consumers, civil liberty, all those of core things. And therefore, a combination of a better principle-based approach and more understanding on where they can just monitor versus having a harder touch regulatory impact is something that has to go hand in hand as these things evolve. And you mentioned very clearly we're moving to this platform economy. That is also something that even for some regulators almost goes against competition to a certain extent. So I think understanding how this new ecosystem is really composed, and some of the things really have been very concentrated. You meant Ant Financial and Alibaba and these sort of very large conglomerates. I mean, that is also not the intention, that the world is eventually run by 2-3 platforms, right? So we need to think about competition in the same way.
But this is one of the odd things about the again, talking about Europe, this is one of the odd things about the thrust of the European regulation at the moment, because the trajectory of it right now is that the APIs will be opened up. Those platforms, you know, Facebook, Google, Amazon, will then come in and have access to the bank accounts, and the commission will have replaced the duopoly that it didn't like, which are Visa and MasterCard, whatever, with this new oligarchy where you have 4 or 5 platforms that run everything. And that can't be what the regulation intended, was it? Especially leaving all of the liability with the banks.
No, it definitely didn't intend it. And I think there was also an underestimation that these large global platforms, and some of them US-based, and that's always Europe versus the US, that sort of discussion. I don't think there was the foresight that these guys would come to the fore and think about how they can use the opportunity presented in the legislation. I think the initial thrust was really to talk about augmenting the consumer experience, having more choice, maybe getting more competition into the system in terms of payments and merchant acquiring. So basically reducing further the credit card usage because of the cost, and enhancing the interoperable environment we created with SEPA in terms of connecting that to the web and having cheaper ACH type services, right? So this is the first line that was envisaged, and whatever comes beyond that wasn't necessarily seen very clearly by the regulator, which is quite natural. I think the other area, in my view, when I look at the cyber risk, because that's something I'm working a lot on in the industry as well, in terms of the security of API and the operational connectivity and the testing and the live setting of any type of third party that can now communicate with banks is a completely open point, because none of this is, of course...
You're exaggerating there, Ruth. We just need to choose longer passwords.
Yeah, well, don't get me on the secure customer authentication, but I think there are a number of open questions as to how this may play out, because if there's more risk or if there are bad consumer experiences as a consequence of certain things being implemented in not exactly the best way, I think they could also backfire in terms of opening up this new consumer experience and having the market grow in that space.
Okay, so we should move on, but Ruth, just before we do, give us a more specific way to get in touch with you or find your book.
Yeah, I think if you Google my name, you see all sorts of videos and books and stuff. And I'm very active talking to regulators really on these topics to help them think about changing the approach to regulation in the future, which is not easy at all. But I think if they don't do it now, they may really lose control of the ecosystem. So just Google my name. I have a Twitter handle, R. Vanthofer, email at Citi. So I'm reachable across all virtual and physical channels.
Very good. Ruth Vanthofer.
Yes.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for joining us on Breaking Banks today.
Thank you very much, Brett.
Okay, so up next, taking us to break, Mike Blaylock, who's the general manager for Intel FSI. Is that correct?
That is correct. Hi, Brett.
Yeah. So, Mike, where are you based?
I'm based in Boston.
Right.
I have a global role. So the general manager for the financial services industry vertical. I have a team of about 55 people that looks at the major end users in financial services across banking, insurance, and capital markets. And our goal is to work with ecosystem partners to deliver solutions based on Intel technology that address business challenges.
Now, so in terms of the core technology that Intel's working on for financial services, what do you consider your core technologies that are mobilizing financial services?
Well, it really spans, Brett, from the, you know, the cloud and the data center, which is just the center of insight and analytics, out to the edge endpoints. So IoT, sensors, wearables, the enterprise client. And then that, you know, our vision is to have this virtual cycle where all this is connected with 5G connectivity. If it's smart and connected, it works best with Intel. And how does that enhance the customer experience and also transform business going forward?
Okay. So what about when we start talking about things like IoT and devices and sensors? Do you guys have like a specific strategy right now for trying to enable data that's going to come into the financial services regime? Like things like location data and other sensor-based stuff.
Absolutely. We're looking, you know, there's a deluge of data coming as we move from a, you know, person-based data ecosystem to a machine-based data ecosystem. You just look at the typical person puts out about 1.5 gigabytes per day of data, whereas an autonomous vehicle put out 4 terabytes per day. So an incredible avalanche of data.
That's a great stat, isn't it?
Is that a lot?
That's 2,600 times the data that a person puts out per day.
You haven't seen my Twitter feed.
Yeah, well, maybe Dave, you're probably higher than the 1.5 gig average person. But the essential thing is, you know, there's a deluge of data. You have to be able to get insight from the data. And the thing that we're working with our banks and end user customers about is how do they address, you know, within the business constraints, we just heard, you know, Ruth talk about regulatory compliance issues, changing customer behaviors, new entrants and competition. How do you have a platform of innovation that you can, you know, deliver new value and services to your customers and put new, you know, technologies like blockchain, like next generation artificial intelligence that Intel is working on, IoT capabilities, you know, that span from edge to cloud with analytics across and hardware, software across the, you know, the entire stack. So that's really what we're working on at Intel, is to try to work and be a technology partner for the financial services industry and help them through this journey and this transition together.
Well, I don't want to fall foul of Breaking Bank's very, very stringent ethical framework. So before I ask the question, I must say that Consult Hyperion has provided paid professional services to Intel. So let's get that out of the way. So I'm very focused on the secure side of things because I'm kind of old school. So I think it's all very well to mess around in software and have long passwords and all that sort of thing. But ultimately, we're going to need hardware.
He's on a mission with passwords today, isn't he?
I am, because if we want to have any real security, it has to be grounded in hardware, I think.
Absolutely agree, Dave, 100%. And we actually have some really exciting solutions that Intel is bringing out, which, you know, hardware-enabled security, both on the client and on the data center and in the cloud. One of the things is around Authenticate, which is a multi-factor authentication. So you can select multiple factors of authentication, who you are, what you know, what you have, is your cell phone nearby, and be able to identify and attest who's on the other end. Because as you start to move to cloud-based delivery of services, the authentication of that endpoint just becomes critical. And as you say, you know, passwords are difficult to remember. They're not the same, you know, there's ways around it. So we're looking at combining hardware and software solutions in all of our platforms to be able to address security concerns that are evolving and will change as we go into the future.
And when it comes into the IoT space, the ability to add, I'm guessing that the ability to add trusted execution environments to, you know, these billions of objects out there, This is a massive opportunity for Intel, right? So you're not that bothered about PCs anymore.
We see that as part of the spectrum of the endpoint and the client.
It's just one of the devices.
It's one of the devices. And actually, it's interesting you bring that up, because one of the areas that we've had a great amount of success with lately is with leveraging that technology that's in this platform for hardware capabilities and authentication with many banks, you know, mobile banking is there, and you have Fast Identity Online, FIDO services in the back end that handle the inputs from the mobile banking world. You're now able to leverage that infrastructure with online banking, because if you look at it, people are still using their PCs for purchases. I forget the number, but anything above $1,200, they're probably buying it on a PC still.
So unless you're in China, where it's like 80% is through mobile.
But, you know, for higher dollar purchases, you're able to, you know, use that capability that's there for the mobile banking with the PC banking as well. So, you know, moving across the entire spectrum from, you know, sensors, wearables, and you know, the client solution on the endpoint, and then also driving the data center cloud requirements in the center.
You see, one of the reasons why I'm so curious about the sort of the kind of SGX-ish approach is that in terms of like big picture privacy and security, this idea of having very strong authentication against local tamper-resistant hardware that contains revocable tokens, rather. That's a way of harnessing the power of biometrics and connectivity and the hardware all together. So architecturally, I have a feeling that we're heading in that direction.
Yes, absolutely.
Now, why don't banks use it then? Because it seems slightly baffling to me that Facebook send me messages that are PGP encrypted and signed. You know, I can use my FIDO U2F to get my sort of Google Mail.
And we can verify using facial identity and,
you know. Right. So how come banks are so slow to use all this stuff?
Well, the technology is there now, and I think we're starting to see banks, you know, evaluate it. There's a lot of POCs that are going on. You know, it actually provides a more frictionless, secure customer experience. They don't have to send out, you know, tokens or, you know, texts to customers to interact. And they can also offer additional services that way. So the SGX capability is very interesting, too, as you start to move to blockchain and authentication there. And I know you've worked with some folks within Intel. We have a Sawtooth Lake solution around blockchain, which provides for increased privacy and security without sacrificing scalability. Uses a very advanced proof of elapsed time consensus mechanism that leverages the SGX capabilities.
So can we just talk about that just for the audience that may not be familiar with it? What is the SGX capability?
These are the software guard extensions that are in our platform on the client. We'll be on the server later this year. And it provides another level of attestation and security for keys, protection of security credentials, when using the Intel platform.
Okay, so for any chip or device, right?
I was going to say, so it's a trusted execution environment. So, right. You know, kind of like your iPhone has the secure enclave and your Samsung's got the TE. It's a similar kind of thing. Although I think yours also scales down more, doesn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
So Dave, let's just take a quick break. And then, Mike, when we come back, I'd like to ask you a question about 3D sensors that we're hearing rumors about in the iPhone. All right, you're listening to Breaking Banks. You're with Brett King and Dave Birch, and we'll be right back after this break.
What do financial services of the future look like? Invisible yet ubiquitous, blended into our lives like air, gravity, this podcast. Temenos has specialized for 20 years in creating the best financial technology for thousands of financial institutions worldwide. Our open fintech marketplace allows millions of people to experience money in exciting new ways. Join the most vibrant financial services ecosystem in the world. Temenos, we make the money go round.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag #BreakingBanks. Now, back to the program.
And we're back from break, and we are still in Guildhall at the Innovate Finance Global Summit. What did you say about the Global Summit, Dave?
I said next year it will be Global Summit in the sense that World Series is World Series.
Yeah, like once it's Brexited.
once we're Billy No Mates Brexit.
Exactly.
It'll all be different. But we're enjoying it being global this year.
Very good.
Next year we'll have a Commonwealth Summit.
The Commonwealth Summit. Okay, so Mike, just before the break, we were talking about some of the technologies that Intel's working on that might affect financial services. But what are the big bets that Intel's making?
So at the our Intel Developer Forum, and over the last 6 months or so, we've talked about really four big bet areas for Intel. The first being virtual reality and augmented reality, new perceptual computing experiences, new experiential computing to drive richer UX. Second is around 5G and 5G connectivity, being able to connect this vast array of Internet of Things and scalable way with enough bandwidth to deliver services now and into the future. And the other one is autonomous vehicles, self-driving cars. Intel's making a lot of plays in this in that area. You just saw the recent announcement that we're looking to acquire Mobileye for computer vision. And the fifth area is around artificial intelligence. It really ties all those together in a way that allows you to get insight from this deluge and avalanche of data that'll be coming in to be able to run your business, provide a better service, and do all the things that you need to do.
I mean, turning those torrents of data into any kind of sort of usable knowledge and deducing some kind of wisdom from it, to me, seems like this massive task at the moment, because the quantities of data involved are just so huge. And a person could never look at this stuff and make anything out of it.
And as the data increases, all it really does is starts to hide the insight versus bring it out. You have to look at whether it's we moving from machine learning into deep learning with some of the acquisitions we've made there with Nirvana, and also memory-based reasoning for cognitive computing with Saffron. But there's not a one-size-fits-all either for AI, as you know. So we look at different technology approaches across different platforms, from Xeon, Xeon Phi, field programmable gate array for acceleration there for AI, as well as some new products like LateCrest that'll be coming out that have deep learning accelerators built into our silicon. So there's a complete spectrum of products that we have to support the AI workloads, along with libraries that we develop, the frameworks that we develop. We support all seven AI frameworks that are out there. And at the end of the day, it's really to try to drive AI, accelerate AI development forward, also to democratize AI, to bring AI to everyone so that they can get full insight out of the data that's going to be available.
So I have to ask, and because we've got to move on to a couple more interviews after this, but Mike, there's always, you must be asked this question about, the end of Moore's Law, and what does the post-Moore's Law Intel look like?
Well, I can say is, that Moore's Law is alive and well and healthy. talking about, there's been a lot of press there that, Intel just had a process of manufacturing day just to kind of address this topic. But we have a healthy, roadmap out there to continue to deliver solutions and continue to scale silicon.
How far does that roadmap go out?
I think right now we've, looking at the 7-nanometer.
Okay, so that's like well beyond 2025,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, that's pretty exciting. Yeah. And you, of course, we're now doing 3D chip platforms.
Well, that's the other thing I wanted to say is around, there's a whole new paradigm around memory technology with 3D memory, where we've actually done things. And this is going to be a complete shift in the memory paradigm, where you're going to be able to have hot, warm and cold storage. You can run very large data sets in memory for in-memory computing real time, terabytes of memory capabilities. So it's going to provide a whole new, set of insight that you can derive from, large data sets that you couldn't do before. So the combination of increased hardware and computing performance, increased memory, performance and data sets, and smarter algorithms are really, we think, going to accelerate this artificial intelligence wave that we're on.
Wow.
Okay. So you got one last question, Doug?
Well, I'm just wondering if artificial intelligence is gonna actually mean more chips or not, because like right now, the NatWest Bank call center is, I don't know, whatever it is, 5,000 people in India or something. They've all got PCs, and in a couple of years' time, it's going to be one of your servers under a desk somewhere, isn't it? Because we'll all just be talking to it and chatting and things. So is AI going to mean more chips?
I think all of these bets we have, all these things are driving demands into the data center. So it's going to, drive compute demand, which then provides new services, new innovations, which then drives more compute demand. So it's this virtuous cycle.
Which is why 5G and things like that are important.
Exactly. Yes.
Great. Well, Mike Blalock from Intel FSI, thanks for joining us on Breaking Banks today.
Thank you, Brett.
Very, very good. So interesting stuff, Dave.
That's great.
All right, so our final interview in the room today is Poppy Gustafsson.
Poppy Gustafsson.
And you are the CEO EMEA for Darktrace.
That's correct. So Darktrace is a world-leading cybersecurity company that's used machine learning and artificial intelligence, as we've been talking about before, to help defend companies such as banks, but not just banks, many other companies in different sectors from the cyber threat.
And you're based here in London?
Yes, well, headquartered in Cambridge and San Francisco, but also yeah, with offices in London.
So we didn't ask this of Ruth, but we should have asked, how's Brexit going to affect your business?
Oh, gosh. Well, who can say? Because who knows what Brexit really looks like? At the moment, we're still seeing significant growth. So we saw a 600% growth on the last year, which I think is, you know, symptomatic of the fact we've got an increasing cyber demand. So as yet, we're seeing no noticeable impact on Brexit. But I can only assume that it will create more uncertainty in the market. And with uncertainty comes risk.
So, go ahead, Dave.
You're from the security side of things.
Yes.
He's going to talk security now.
No, well, I just want to ask. I'm curious about the arms race on the security side of things, because it seems to me that I was at a talk the other day by what's the guy's name, the antivirus guy,
McAfee.
No, the other one, Kaspersky. Okay. He's a very entertaining speaker, you know.
And McAfee's entertaining as well.
And he was talking about. You know, the kind of arms race that's going on. So I sort of wanted to ask about that, but in the AI augmented context. Is that okay?
So we
need to ask what Darktrace actually does, first of all. Okay.
Yeah, so tell us about the machine learning capability that you built at Darktrace and what it does.
Okay, so Darktrace was founded about 4 years ago. And when Darktrace was founded, up until that point, cybersecurity had all been about sort of keeping the bad guys off your network.
Yeah.
So if you think about it, me trying to defend my house from a burglar, it was, you know, what's valuable in my house? How do I build a big wall around it? How do I keep the bad guys out? Darktrace's approach to this was to flip that on its head and to think, well, perhaps a cyber breach is inevitable. And instead, how do we detect that anomalous behavior as it occurs in real time? Because technology is increasing at such a rate, networks are becoming so increasingly complex, it's hard to identify what data is at threat within your network, let alone identify weaknesses where that data can be exfiltrated. So instead, let's assume that breach is inevitable and focus our attention on identifying behaviors within the network that may be symptomatic of an attack.
So what's the data you take from the network to plug into your machine?
It's just raw network traffic that comes in. It sits passively within the network and it has no concerns about whether that data is encrypted. So it's not looking at the data. It's not reading the data. It's looking at that network flow and the normal pattern of life. Yes, who's talking to who, how particular devices behave normally, whether devices are similar or behaving similarly. And by sort of understanding that data, it can detect then the anomalous behavior.
Cool.
So I've often thought about the future security systems that we have to build. And who was that girl from Israel, Karen, that we had on the show? I can't remember her name now.
She was smart.
Yeah, she described it like an immune system. So that machine learning will be able to learn and respond like an immune system to attacks. Is that a good analogy?
That is definitely an analogy that we use very strongly at Darktrace. So if we think about our human immune system, it's complex and incredible one, but one that's enabled us to move from living in sort of small little families to being able to expand and live in large communities and interact with masses of people around us without fear of infection or something like that.
Except I read yesterday that measles is on the rise in Europe.
That's so because of
Trump. Someone's not using machine learning.
So, our immune system will hopefully enable us to defend against measles. So extrapolating against that, so our immune system has it at its core, that innate sense of self. So only by identifying self can you identify that other, even if that other is in the form of a virus or bacteria that our bodies can never seen before. And then we can adapt and mount a defense and write the code of that defense into our immunological memory. So that's quite a useful analogy for Darktrace is concerned.
But how do you tell what's the... So Money Box is the radio for consumer finance program that we all listen to. Well, all of us that listen to Radio 4. And so I have a Money Box game, which is like you turn on, but 2 minutes after the start, and you hear a member of the public talking about how they were talked out of their life savings and their money was all stolen and stuff like that. And you have to try and guess whether it was done by a regulated financial institution or by hackers.
and you try and guess before they say in the show. And so my problem with the kind of machine learning thing would be, how can you tell? Like, there's collusion going on about LIBOR, there's people doing unauthorized trading, there's people trying to get emails they shouldn't get. How can you tell what's employees and what's hackers?
I think this for me is a prime example of where machine learning really comes into the forefront, because you're trying to say, this is what the threat looks like. How are you going to tell me, Darktrace, when this threat is identified? And instead, I'm not going to say that. Instead, I'm going to say, this is what you look like. This is what normally happens. And this is when something is different. Now, that could be an intentional malicious attack, or it could just be human error. So for example, as part of our process, we go in and deploy our technology within a customer environment and demonstrating it working. And we find something that they weren't expecting 80% of the time. A prime example for this is once we deployed within a law firm and they were operating swipe card systems for at the canteen to buy themselves lunch and so on and so forth. And they could buy themselves a can of Diet Coke from the Coke machine, except each and every time that they did that, all of their personal details from their cards or their payroll numbers, national insurance and so on and so forth was going to the Coke machine vendor. Now, this was not a malicious attack, and you would never sort of code that in and program a machine to look out for that. But because it was anomalous and because it knew that that type of machine, it didn't know it was a vending machine, but it knew that others around it weren't behaving in that similar way. It could identify that behavior as anomalous, flag it, and it could be corrected before it was a major breach. So I think, yes, we do need to be wary of sort of malicious attacks and identifying how they can behave. But also a lot of breaches is not malicious and is just through human error and not understanding the way that a network necessarily
So your system wouldn't necessarily, so your system would say, hey, it looks like someone from the Bank of England's talking to somebody in your LIBOR department. We don't know whether that's good or bad. It's nothing to do with us. But hey, it doesn't normally happen. That's what your system
exactly
would say.
It's just something that's out of the usual pattern of life of that particular network.
So, in respect to what we were talking with Mike about before and overall, when do we get to the point where humans can no longer manage network security?
Oh, surely we're at that point now, aren't we?
Our resourcing is a massive problem. So this is something that comes up time and again, and people are having a big information security team, and you know that resource is under a lot of pressure. Mostly because, unfortunately, cyber attackers don't tend to do it between 9 to 5 and nice office hours. It's normally in the middle of the night when most people like to be at home tucked up in their bed and not looking out for attacks. Also, what we're seeing is that the speed of cyber attacks is happening much faster. So, for example, with ransomware, which is a sort of attack that goes into your network and then as quickly as possible encrypts as much of it network as it can, indiscriminately. They're not after a particular valuable piece of information. They just want to stop the institution operating as it normally would. That is something that can happen very, very quickly. Within seconds, you can see vast quantities of data being attacked. Now, that is not something that a human being could respond quick enough. So what we're starting to see now is the application of machine learning in not only identifying that attack, but also starting to take action against it. So if it could identify a ransomware behavior, which is something that's very easy to identify because it's very anomalous, it can then start slowing down those connections or even stopping them.
Wow.
Which then allows that human being to come in and take action by the machine responding faster than a human being ever could. And this for me is the first step in networks not only being able to identify their own risks, but also being able to take action against them. So becoming self-healing, if you like.
So someone said the other day, bearing in mind most IoT devices don't use Intel SGX or anything else yet, how did we get into the situation where a network that was supposed to stop, was supposed to survive nuclear war, can be brought down by a load of toasters that are all connected together? So there are these bot armies out there that are fighting your bots, I guess, bot versus bot. We're not really in the loop about this. But how did we get into this situation?
There is no CISO of a bank today that would build their network from the ground up today the way that it currently exists. Often these networks are an accumulation of years of acquired networks that are stitched together, and technology is getting ahead at such a rate. Just look at the move to the cloud for the non-traditional IP, such as your air conditioning units and your smart TVs that are connecting to your network. this is racing ahead at such a phenomenal rate. It's very difficult for banks to sort of keep up. And that is a fundamental point where I think that people need to start accepting that at some point that breach is inevitable and instead start focusing attention on how they can identify that threat before any real harm is caused. So before a small problem become a crisis.
Are there any bank CSOs here?
Here today?
Yeah.
I should hope so.
Well, we should get together and go around and give that Tim Berners-Lee a bit of a kicking, because this this open web nonsense, just letting anybody connect, this is where all the trouble comes from. We should never have let the general public get involved, if you ask me.
All right. So listen, Poppy, how do we find out more information about Darktrace?
Just take a look at our website, darktrace.com. Yeah, and please do have a look at the Enterprise Immune System.
Thanks for joining us on at Innovate Finance Global Summit today.
Thank you very much for having me. I've enjoyed it.
Okay, so Dave.
If you want one comment, I would say that I think the way that Ruth framed the early part of the conversation, a lot of the stuff that we think of as fintech stuff is really going to, you know, the impact it's going to have is actually as reg tech stuff.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, so if we can use biometric quantum blockchains or whatever it is to mean that we can send payments 5% quicker between two banks, who cares? I mean, that's not going to change the,
yeah,
you know, the shape of our industry is driven by regulation.
Absolutely.
And if we can use these technologies to make that cheaper, faster, more effective, then we'll really be changing things.
All right, right? So I did it earlier, an interview with Costa Perry. Let's hear what he has to say about how all of this technology is enabling Africa and places like that. And of course, Costa's from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation.
Never heard of them.
Costa Perry, it's been a while. Welcome back to Breaking Banks.
Hey, Brett. Really a pleasure to see you here. A little bit like a serendipity, but here you go. A pleasure.
Absolutely. It's always good to get back with the old band, you know. So so tell me, what is Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation's goals for 2017 in terms of financial inclusion, the work you guys are doing?
Yeah. So what we want to do is, as you know, we've built up Level One project as a kind of a map for financial inclusion digital payment platforms. 2017 is about hitting the ground with that and starting deployments of Level One project compliant platforms in various countries in Africa and Asia.
You know, in terms of Africa, what's happening in Africa, because you visit there quite frequently, I guess, and we just did a show recently on M-Pesa. We had Bob Collymore on the show and KCB. Fascinating. But, you know, what's your feeling for the progress that's been made on in terms of getting people into this financial system in Africa?
So in a nutshell, it's going to be from pioneers to consolidation. So M-Pesa is a great example, huge success, very positive. The one thing, though, that M-Pesa doesn't do is doesn't reach out to everyone, because however powerful one particular provider is, they will never get to like 100%. So the big story I can see now happening is in neighboring Tanzania, where four mobile money providers, none of which is like dominant, they figured out that the best way forward is to actually interoperate. And that makes a lot of sense. And since they actually did this, you can see the volume of transactions jump up considerably immediately after that. So it makes a lot of sense. It's like it wouldn't make sense if you couldn't call everyone on your mobile phone, right? Well, with mobile money systems, it's the same. So I'd say that's big, huge progress, Tanzania. We also see a lot of consolidation on the markets, like Western Africa is like now having a regional approach to digital financial systems, right? Rather like a country by country. So these regional consolidations are truly important. And if we like project this in the future, maybe one day all Africa will be connected in an interoperable system. So that's amazing.
I thought that's where you were going with it. So, yeah. You know, we hear this stat, you might have an update for us, but how many countries, and if you don't know, then you can tell me, but how many countries in Africa are there more mobile money accounts now than bank accounts? Is that a stat that you're aware of?
I don't know it by heart. You know, I'm bad with numbers, but I don't know by heart, but it's a very I think it's in many countries it would be the rule rather than the exception. Yeah.
Now, what are you doing here in London at Innovate Finance?
So here I'm here to share some very good news. We have been lucky to have four technology service providers decide to interoperate and design a new API for interoperability. So Ericsson, Huawei, Comviva, and Telepin, who are the providers for mobile money operators. With our help for convening them, they are designing this open API, and they will modify their products so that out of the box they interoperate, and that API will be available in the fall. It's huge, huge progress. I'm really happy to share the news here, and we'll have a workshop later today to share in some more details. But it really shows that these commercial companies who have bottom line objectives, they understand, one, that there is a huge opportunity with the unbanked, serving the unbanked. Two, that this is actually a business. It's not charity. It's actually a business of serving the poor, and they get it. So it's hugely important. I'm really happy to share this news here.
So how quickly do you think you'll be able to roll out something on this platform?
Oh, once the API is done, these guys are in the countries in Africa and Asia. I'm sure right after we'll see some very concrete announcement from them.
And just so finally, you know, in terms of Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, you know, the commitment to financial inclusion, how important is that to the foundation?
Thanks for the question. It's something we don't talk enough about. So financial services for the poor, there is like our own strategy goals of poverty alleviation. We know that connecting people to a financial system is actually a poverty alleviation tool, and that's great. That's the main objective. But we also serve as a resource to other foundation strategies, because if you want to help farmers, at some point you're going to have to pay money and have them connect as well. So we serve as a resource to agriculture, to health, vaccine. So that's why it's hugely important for the foundation. We are like a little bit of a foundational strategy.
Well, Costa Peric, thanks for being on Breaking Banks again today.
With great pleasure, anytime.
Good to see you.
Good to see you, Brett.
Okay, so I'm here with Paul Taylor at the Global Summit for Innovate Finance, and you run a very interesting business called Thought Machine. What is Thought Machine?
Thought Machine is a fintech company based in London, and we are inventing retail banks in the cloud. So effectively, trying to solve the problem of legacy IT that plagues nearly every bank in the world, and taking, you know, a very modern approach to build a kind of completely real-time, scalable bank which runs in the cloud.
Now, this involves a lot of machine learning and AI, because you've got a PhD in machine learning, right?
Yes, I do. I got that. It's actually in speech technology, but it's a branch of machine learning. I got that in the early 90s. I'm much older than I look.
That's pretty freaking cool, though.
Yeah, and I mean, I've been fascinated by machine learning since I started. When I first encountered AI and saw people using hard and fast rules to try and solve problems, I thought, this is not how the human brain works. You know, we need to do something that has kind of soft borders, or, you know, kind of fuzzy logic, or various other things involved in it. So I've always been fascinated. My company started out doing machine learning in banking, but kind of found it difficult. We could run good systems offline, as in just with the data set, but to do it in real time was hard because the bank's legacy IT systems couldn't support that. So we kind of did a bit of a turn and decided to fix the foundations before we were mending the roof, so to speak, and decided to focus our energy on building, you know, a bank that was really real time. It had none of the data problems. And on top of that, then you could start to do machine learning and solve the problems that we've been talking about.
Can you talk about who some of your bank partners are that you're working with?
Only in the abstract. So we'll be going live, but we're working with several tier one banks. We're working with some challenger banks. And a lot of what we're doing is effectively a typical customer. We talk to a lot of banks, but the typical customer would be somebody who comes to has already decided that they can't stand it any longer. The legacy IT is crippling their organization, and they want to do something new. And originally, we were just going to do the core bit of the bank, but a lot of the banks say that's no good. They want a completely new system. It includes treasury and risk and compliance and, you know, and everything else and build that. So those are the sort of things people are doing. There's also quite an interesting move about internal challenger banks. So the challenger banks are well known in the UK and they've really blazed the trail and got everybody excited and stirred a lot of things up. And a lot of banks are reacting. You know, why can we not have a lightweight digital only bank? And again, very focused on consumer needs, very kind of, gives products that are particular to people's needs. You know, why can't we do that? It doesn't mean to say we've got to get rid of the old bank, but we can certainly, we can't just take the challenger bank problem lying down.
So can banks do this stuff themselves, or does this require new blood, new thinking?
I think a lot of banks, there is a change in how banks work. Smaller banks have always used suppliers. That makes sense. If you've only got 1,000 people in the bank, you will not have enough people to build the technology. But larger banks, tier one banks, have nearly always built their kit in-house. But I think there's a real change in that attitude as well. I think part of the problem is that there's kind of a difficult culture in how IT systems are generally deployed in banks. And I think there's a lot of awareness about that. It's that, you know, when budgets are big and we could afford large waterfall projects that ran for hundreds of millions of dollars over many, many years, that's fine. But the technology, forget about the fintech world, but the technology world doesn't work like that anymore. We have agile programming, we ship every week, and that kind of attracts the talent. People think it's cool to do that sort of stuff. I think it's cool to do that sort of stuff. And, you know, we are being, not just my company, Thought Machine, but other companies are being very competitive in terms of how a few dozen people can produce a really good product. 5 years ago, I think banks would have said, well, that's cool, but whatever. Banks take us very seriously. And it's, and they are humble because what they have are great customer relationships and great knowledge about how to run a bank. But they realize that they haven't kept up on in the technology space.
So, Paul, how do we find out about Thought Machine?
Well, thoughtmachine.net is there. Plenty of stuff on the website about how the company works. Machine learning, smart contracts, various things like that. Of course, just get in contact with us if you want to build a bank with us.
And what's your Twitter ID?
PaulT31415. I don't use it much, I will say that.
Okay, fair enough. Well, thanks very much for joining us on Breaking Banks today.
Okay, thank you very much.
We ran into our good friend Will Beeson, who runs the Rebank podcast, right, Will? So what are you doing at Innovate Finance?
Sure. So I'm here as part of my work with Civilized Bank. We're a startup bank here in the UK, looking to launch late this year, focused on the SME space. So we've seen a lot of activity recently in the retail space, digital-only, mobile-only banks. Civilized Bank is addressing a much-needed and underserved segment, the SME segment here in the UK.
And you're applying for a license right now? So how far along in that process are you?
We are more than a year into it. It is a long process. There are two regulators involved, and it takes time. It takes resources. It takes experienced people. And it ends up with a lot of paperwork and if all goes well, a stamp of approval at the end.
And tell us about the podcast and where you guys are at with Rebank.
Yeah, the podcast has been a great kind of side project to promote certainly everything that's going on in fintech in London, but also globally think about ways to connect with the most active people in the space. Brett, that's how you and I connected, as well as a number of our mutual acquaintances. So I think we've, the time of recording, put out about 33 episodes with the movers, shakers, thinkers, doers in the space, including yours truly, Brett King.
Well, Will, thanks for saying hello and good luck with the new bank, the startup.
Thanks, Brett. Take care.
Well, that was a very full show today. We had a lot to get through. Thanks for staying with us. It was a lot of fun being in London for the Innovate Finance Global Summit. I hope to see you guys back on the show next week. You're listening to Breaking Banks. Don't forget, go to iTunes, give us a review. We'd be very grateful. We will see you guys on Breaking Banks again next week. Bye.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time for more of the latest in fintech news.